Hi, John.
Hey, Sean, how are you?
Very good.
Why don't you introduce yourself again for the Blogging Head viewers, and then I'll introduce myself.
Sure, I'm Sean Carroll. I'm a theoretical physicist specializing in cosmology, and I'm at Caltech.
And I'm John Horgan. I'm a science writer and occasional correspondent on science at Blogging Heads TV.
Right.
And I thought today, Sean, that I'm really excited about this show, actually, because I thought that you and I can go through everything that's happening in modern cosmology and separate what is credible from what's bullshit.
What are we going to do for the other 50 minutes of the show? I don't understand how we will...
You know, I'm thinking that this might actually get a little complicated. You know, actually, I wanted to start with a fairly basic question. The Big Bang itself, the idea of the expanding universe, you periodically see headlines. I mean, this goes back decades when science writers are trying to attract attention to something that they've written. They say the Big Bang theory is in trouble, it's wobbling, new questions about the foundations of it. So could you start by telling us about the status of the Big Bang theory itself?
Sure. One of the sources of complication is that the phrase Big Bang really has at least three different meanings that people sort of use semi-interchangeably, so it's worth separating those out.
Mm-hmm.
One is an event, right? One is the very beginning of the universe, T equals zero, where it all started, the singularity that is predicted in ordinary classical general relativity, and, you know, what happens at that moment. Another is the framework of an expanding universe that started from a very hot, dense state and went through what we ordinarily think of as the synthesis of the light elements and the formation of atoms and so forth, and expanded and cooled into what we see today.
Mm-hmm.
And the final one is some specific version of that framework, like a cold dark matter model, or a model with a cosmological constant, or a model with a certain kind of fluctuations and so forth.
Okay.
So, and all of these three have very different statuses. The first one, the Big Bang as a moment in time, or the beginning of time, is absolutely conjectural. We know nothing about what happened at T equals zero. Our theory breaks down. Some of us try to sort of push beyond what we know to understand that, but nobody claims that we've figured out what goes on at that moment.
Right.
The second one, the general framework of starting in a hot, dense state, expanding according to the laws of gravity, and cooling off into what we see today, is rock solid established. There's no controversy about it within the non-crackpot physics community. Everyone believes that the evidence is far past overwhelming, that that is the right basic picture for the evolution of the universe.
Right.
The final one, the specific versions of the Big Bang, the specific models with various choices of parameters, of course, gets revised and updated all the time. We think that we've settled into something which we now call the concordance model or something like that. But over the last several decades, sure, we've learned a lot about the universe. We've learned a lot about the parameters, what it's made of, and so forth, where the perturbations in the early universe came from that led to galaxies and large-scale structure today. And so we've been revising those models as we go in response to the data. And I think those kinds of movements in response to data and improved theories are what sometimes misleadingly gets reported as Big Bang theory in trouble. The actual framework of the Big Bang, the universe is about 14 billion years old, expanded from a hot, dense state, is in no trouble at all, and it's not ever going to be in trouble.
Okay, that makes it really clear. It seems to me that the situation is somewhat analogous to the theory of evolution. So if you go back right to the beginning of the history of life, there's a mystery there as to how life started in the first place. That's analogous, I guess, to how exactly the universe exploded into being, what preceded it, if anything, and so forth. And then you've got the question of working out the details of exactly how the universe evolved to its present condition. And so you've got questions about the details of how the universe came to be in its current state that are sort of analogous to the details that are still being worked out about evolution, but in both cases, the foundations are really secure.
I think that's exactly right. There's details to be worked out, and hopefully there will be for a long time, so full employment for cosmologists and evolutionary biologists. But the framework is in place. No one sensibly is saying that Darwin was fundamentally wrong. No one is saying that George Gamow and Edwin Hubble and Lemaître were fundamentally wrong. And the beginning, the origin point, is a mystery. It's more of a mystery in cosmology, I think, even than in biology. We can at least make some plausible conjectures about the origin of life, even do the occasional experiment in the jar to see if you can make amino acids and maybe someday a protein. In cosmology, it's more confusing than that. We have less of a handle on what happened at the very beginning, but there's an increasing effort to try to understand that, given the rules that we do know.
Okay, now, going back to the birth of the universe itself, over the past, it's almost 30 years now, there's been this idea called inflation that has become very popular among cosmologists, and like the Big Bang Theory itself, it comes in lots of different versions now. I wonder if you can briefly talk about the basic idea of inflation, and then we can get into some of the debate over how right or wrong it is and what different versions might be right or wrong.
Sure. The basic idea of inflation is to try to help provide some sort of reason why the early universe looks the way it does. And there's basically, roughly speaking, two camps you're welcome to fall into here. One is that this is not a question we should be asking. The universe is what it is, and our job is to deal with it, you know, to figure out what it is like, but not ask why it is one way rather than the other. And that's an internally consistent position, I think.
Can you just tell us how many of your colleagues hold that position these days? Because those aren't the ones that you ordinarily are hearing from these days or reading articles by.
Sure. I mean, for obvious reasons. If you don't think it's an interesting question, you don't write about it, right? You don't think, you do something else.
Yeah.
So those of us who are professional theoretical cosmologists are generally trying to provide some understanding, some mechanism, some reason why the universe is this way rather than some other way. We think that's an interesting question.
Yeah. And so so what's the basic physical mechanism that supposedly underpins inflation?
Well, I should first sort of say why we even wonder, put the question in this way, because it wouldn't be such a problem if the universe were in some sense natural. Physicists have a way of thinking about systems, you know, gas in a box or something like that, in which we can say, well, this configuration just sort of would be chosen randomly. It sort of makes sense. It's most configurations are like that. But the universe isn't like that at all. The universe is not at all in a random, natural, easily chosen configuration of its constituents.
Mm-hmm.
And one way of making that clear is to look at the very early universe, and certain of the features of the very early universe are very finely tuned, very exactly close to certain parameter values that they could easily have been very different. A classic example is the large-scale homogeneity and isotropy of the universe. If you look today at the distribution of galaxies billions of light-years apart, in any large region of the universe, you get the same number of galaxies, the same density of matter, the same basic physical features.
Right.
But these are regions that are hugely separated by billions of light-years, and in a conventional cosmology, it's much worse than that. These are regions that were never in contact with each other,
mm-hmm.
that you would have to travel faster than the speed of light to get from one region to another. So why do they have the same conditions? That's the kind of problem, the kind of puzzle that inflation was originally proposed to try to solve.
Right. And I guess another related problem is, why is space flat? So according to general relativity, you could have had a universe in which space is curved, even curved dramatically in one way or another, and what we observe out there is that space is almost perfectly flat. That's my impression.
This is a little bit confusing because Einstein says that space-time is curved in the presence of a gravitational field. And so for our universe, space-time is definitely curved. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
But in cosmology, when we can make this very, very good approximation that space looks more or less the same everywhere, except that it's expanding as a function of time, then the curvature of space-time divides into two different chunks. One chunk is the expansion rate. The faster you're expanding, the more gravity there is, the more space-time curvature there is. But there's also a separate feature, which is space at any one moment of time can have its own curvature. It can be flat, like Euclid said it should be, or it could be positively curved like a sphere, or negatively curved like a saddle shape. And any one of these is perfectly allowed. And what is worse, if you're in an ordinary universe, by which I mean a universe that has in it nothing but ordinary matter and radiation, no funny dark energy or anything like that, the amount of curvature would grow with time. A little bit of curvature early on would grow to a lot of curvature later. Mm-hmm. We look around our current universe and the curvature is very small, which means that in the past it had to be incredibly small. The universe is very close to spatially flat. That's why Euclid thought that it should be like that, because when you do a little experiment, you draw a triangle, you measure the angles inside, they will add up to 180 degrees. That's a characteristic feature of a flat space, and you can extend that from a tabletop to billions of light years across.
And
so that is another
lines,
one of the puzzles that inflation is trying to solve.
And parallel lines never meet. So my understanding of how inflation solves that problem and the problem of why space looks and the structure of galaxies and matter and the universe looks more or less the same in all directions is that you started out with this almost infinitely small, dense point of matter that then expanded unimaginably rapidly, even faster than the speed of light, and you're going to have to explain how that's possible to us. And at the very beginning, it was completely homogeneous, and then it expanded through this inflationary process, and that's what I want you to explain to us. And so it looks pretty much the same in all directions because of this this process. But and that explains some of this some of these phenomena that you've just been describing. But what explains that? That moment of incredibly rapid inflation in the first place. What in physics leads some cosmologists to think that that might have happened other than this kind of circumstantial evidence that you're describing?
Sure. Well, so there's two things I want to say very quickly. We can elaborate on them later. One is that there's no such thing as expanding faster than the speed of light. That is not the right way to say it, but there's good reasons why people say it that wrong way, and we can clear that up.
Okay.
And the other is, it's a little bit misleading to say an infinitely small point. There was a small patch, but with a finite size, that grew into our present universe. And so inflation doesn't really address the question that we started with of what happens at T equals zero, at the Big Bang itself. Inflation imagines that we've started after that, that there may not even be such a thing as the Big Bang. We start in some universe that already exists, and inflation tries to explain how a tiny little patch of space with a very high energy density can grow and expand into what we see today.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic mechanism is just that I put that little caveat in there before when talking about the flatness of the universe. In the universe that is made, who has stuff in it, which is just ordinary matter, dark matter, radiation, the perturbations, the differences in density from place to place, the lumpiness of that stuff, tends to grow with time. Galaxies come together out of very tiny fluctuations in density from place to place as the universe expands. Likewise, the curvature grows with time. If you have a tiny little bit of spatial curvature in such a universe, it would get bigger. But what Alan Guth, who invented inflation, noticed is that if instead of matter and radiation, you have something like dark energy, some sort of energy density that doesn't dilute away as the universe expands, but remains a constant amount of energy per cubic centimeter, then those processes work in reverse. In the presence of dark energy, the curvature of the universe decreases with time. It doesn't increase. The universe becomes flatter and flatter, and also the perturbations in the universe tend to evaporate away. They tend to get ironed out by this dark energy.
And
the typical analogy that is used is to imagine sort of a wrinkled sheet on your bed, and the effect of the very rapid expansion driven by dark energy is just like pulling out at the corners of that sheet, and all the wrinkles and all the curvature get flattened out just because you're stretching things.
But Sean, why? What makes you think that this this period of incredibly rapid expansion would take place in at all. So my understanding is that somehow, and I've written so much about inflation, and I'll be honest, I still don't, and I've talked to Alan Guth and Andre Linde and Paul Steinhardt and all the people who conceived this back in the late 70s and early 80s, and I still don't really get what the physics is. So, you know, one of the ways it's been explained to me is that gravity suddenly becomes a repulsive and instead of attractive force, and everything is just and there's nothing that resists it, so everything just flies apart, and it's not and it's actually space that's expanding faster than the speed of light. That was how it was put to me. But what are the physics, and how solid are the physics that are behind this supposed mechanism? Is there any reason to believe, is there any experimental evidence to think that this might actually have happened or still be occurring somewhere?
Yeah, so there is very strong experimental evidence that it can happen and has begun to happen again right now, whether or not it happened in the early universe. So the physics is just that the expansion of the universe responds in different ways to the different constituents of the universe. And I don't like the language of saying the universe expanded faster than the speed of light, and I don't like the language of saying that the gravity suddenly became repulsive. Mm-hmm. Gravity is gravity. Gravity is what Einstein's equations say. The difference is that instead of ordinary matter and radiation, you now have dark energy. So the point of dark energy is that if you take a little cube of space, a little cubic centimeter, and you clear it out so that there's nothing there, there's no particles, there's no heat or light or matter or dark matter or anything, you can ask the question, what is the energy contained in that little cubic centimeter? And the answer is not necessarily going to be zero. It's some constant number, according to Einstein. And it can be a constant throughout space and throughout time, although it can be a constant that sort of changes dramatically at some sort of phase transition. The equivalent of ice melting to form water changes the features of space, and that would change the energy density of empty space. Mm-hmm. And what happens if you have an energy that doesn't go away as the universe expands, unlike particles, unlike matter and radiation that get diluted under the ordinary expansion of space, the dark energy remains the same density, the same number of ergs per cubic centimeter, and then you just plug that into Einstein's equation. What it says is that that consistent energy density provides a consistent impulse to the expansion of the universe. So the expansion of the universe doesn't slow down if it's being pushed by dark energy. It slows down if it's being pushed by ordinary matter and radiation because they tend to dilute away.
So I take it that when you say there's evidence for this, that would be the acceleration of the universe that was discovered, I guess, what?
10 years ago. Yeah.
But that, the acceleration that we're observing now is quite leisurely. Otherwise, it wouldn't have taken so long to observe it. It's fairly subtle.
Sure, the numbers are very different. I mean, the thing that we're beginning to feel now is not the same as what we purportedly felt during inflation. The amount of dark energy now is enormously smaller than it needed to be during inflation. But the physical mechanism is the same.
Well, let me just cut to the chase. So my understanding is that there have been no Nobel Prizes awarded for inflation, even though Guth came up with it, I think, in 79 or 80, and there was Andre Linde was thinking about it around the same period. So it's been almost 30 years now. And, you know, you've had people who claim that some of the observations of the microwave background and fluctuations in it and so forth confirm inflation. I actually had a bet with a guy named Mike Reardon at Slack more than 10 years ago that he bet that Alan Guth or someone else would win a Nobel Prize for inflation by the year 2000. That obviously hasn't happened. My prediction is that it won't happen because the evidence for inflation is just too circumstantial for those sticklers on the Nobel Prize committee.
Yeah, I think if you can continue to find suckers to take that bet, you're going to make a lot of money. Nobel Prizes, number one, are not a very good measure of scientific achievement. Einstein never won the Nobel Prize for inventing general relativity, so it's just not the right way of judging whether something is useful or correct or not.
Hmm.
In the case of inflation, it is very true that all the evidence is circumstantial. We have nowhere near the confidence right now to be able to say inflation almost certainly happened. I would say myself, I mean, among theoretical cosmologists, I'm probably more of a skeptic of inflation than most are. I understand what it's supposed to do. I think that it has a lot of deep conceptual hurdles to overcome before it can be said to do this. And it's very difficult to find enough evidence in favor of it that we could say once and for all that inflation really did happen.
Do you think we'll ever reach a point? Is there any possible accelerator data, any kind of laboratory evidence that could convince people that this mechanism of dark energy leading to this extraordinary repulsive force, that could ever, will laboratory evidence for that sort of physics ever be produced, do you think? Is there any chance of that?
Well, yes and no. Let's separate out three different questions once again. One is the question, can an energy density of empty space cause space to expand in an accelerated way like inflation requires? And there, the answer is yes. It's happening right now. We observe it in the stars. So I think that one's been answered. And that was an open question more than 10 years ago. Now we know the answer. The second one is, can the amount of dark energy change at a phase transition? Can you have a rearrangement of the fields in space-time to go from one value of the dark energy to the other one? That one has not been experimentally tested, but all the laws of physics as we understand them say that can happen. That probably happened more than once in the history of the universe. Every time you have a phase transition, that's going to happen. There's an electroweak phase transition, there's a strong force phase transition. We expect that to happen. So the second question is, we definitely expect changes in the dark energy density, although we haven't yet observed it. The third question is, was there actually the correct kind of change in the dark energy density at very, very early times and very early, very high densities to make inflation happen? And that one, sadly, is outside the reach of present-day particle accelerators or any planned particle accelerator. For better or for worse, the kinds of energies that we're talking about in inflation are many orders of magnitude bigger, 10 to the 14 times bigger than we're presently looking at in particle accelerators.
10 to the 14, wow.
As just a random number, anywhere between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 15 or 16 would keep me happy, but something like
right.
that. So there's good news and bad news. The bad news is, by going to the Large Hadron Collider or another particle accelerator to look for evidence of the kind of physics that would have led to inflation is probably not going to happen. The
yeah.
good news is that if inflation did happen, and we can somehow probe it using the microwave background or gravitational waves or something like that, it will be telling us something about physics at energy scales far above what we can reach in a particle accelerator.
Let me ask another question. Can inflation be falsified at this point? And, the reason I'm skeptical that it can be is because you guys are just too damn clever. So, Andre Linde, Mike Turner once said about Andre that he comes up with 10 new theories of the universe before he has breakfast every morning. He's had all these different versions of inflation, and my impression is that inflation is in sort of the same category as string theory now, that there's so many different versions of it, it can be tweaked in so many different ways that it can't be falsified by any conceivable astrophysical or accelerator data.
Well, I think that there's a real problem and a fake problem here. There's a real problem in that, like you say, there are many, many models of inflation. And the number of models, the number of specific instantiations of this idea, seems to be much larger than the number of parameters we can hope to measure using our current technology in particle accelerators or in the microwave background or something like that. So even if you believe in inflation, to pin down precisely which model is right seems to be a very difficult task, although we keep inventing new probes, so who knows? I tend to be optimistic about these things, even if I don't know how it will work out. But the other problem is that, somehow it's not falsifiable, I just think is a complete red herring. I think that that it's this, application of sophomore-level philosophy of science to a really subtle and complicated problem. at heart, inflation is not a theory. There's no, you know, theory of inflation. You haven't written down new laws of physics. Inflation is a prediction. Inflation is a statement that if the laws of physics have a certain form, if they have the right fields and the conditions in the universe were correct, inflation will happen. So it's not a matter of testing inflation. It's a matter of falsifying a set of field theory ideas about what physics is like at an ultra-high energy scale. So yeah. When you falsify something, if that's what you are trying to do, you don't falsify a specific idea within the framework, you need to falsify the entire framework. Yeah. So if we have ways using proton decay or new particle accelerator ideas or new astrophysical ideas to separately probe the physics at the energy scales of inflation, then we would perhaps be able to pin down which kind of inflationary model was appropriate, and that would really be able to let us say with confidence that something like inflation was right. I don't, again, think that that's something that we can confidently predict is going to happen in the short term, but it's certainly possible that will happen, and there's no law of nature that says the short term is the only term that we need to think about.
Is it possible that inflation could be that all the most plausible versions of inflation are contradicted by the best data that you can get, and that you'd be sort of forced back to this default position that you described at the very beginning, where you just sort of accept the universe as it is, and you accept that you can't explain some of these features about its flatness and homogeneity and the distribution of matter and so forth.
Yeah, I mean,
will you guys never accept that?
No, I think that is a much more realistic version of how science really works. It's not that you figure out a way to make a golden experiment, then you do that experiment, then you're happy. It's more like you do a lot of theoretical work trying to understand how the idea could work. You do a lot of experimental work looking at, you know, what the microwave background is telling you and so forth, and you either gain or lose confidence that this is a good idea. So far, inflation has just kept making predictions that have come true. It predicted that the spatial curvature was zero, and it is. It predicted that there were primordial fluctuations in density with a scale invariant spectrum, and there are. It predicted that the spectrum was not exactly scale invariant, and that seems to be true in the most recent microwave background data. None of these are cut and dried. It increases people's confidence that something like inflation was right, because those things might not have been there, but they are there, so we think that we're on the right track. It could happen that in the future we get more data and we begin to go on the wrong track. We begin to think that the natural expected predictions of inflation begin to fall short of what the data are telling us. And then either people will try to invent a better theory, they're already trying, but they will succeed in inventing a better theory to explain these data, or something like you say is going to be true, where we say, well, this is just the kind of thing we have to accept. I think that's very unlikely that the latter thing is going to happen, because when you find this kind of unnatural feature in the universe, it's very, very... it rubs scientists the wrong way to say, well, that's an unnatural feature, let's just deal with it.
Right.
We think this is a clue. We think that this is telling us something about the workings of nature, and that our job is to take that clue and use it to understand something that we didn't understand before. The fact that the early universe is in such an unnatural, weird, unlikely configuration is a huge clue. I would say that it's the most obvious, blatant, brute fact about the universe in which we live that still requires an explanation. And I think that inflation is probably going to be part of that explanation, but we're ultimately going to even need to go beyond inflation to ask why inflation ever happened. What happened before inflation? Without that kind of understanding, inflation is a lot less compelling.
Okay, I can feel a segue coming up, but let me ask you first, why Paul Steinhardt, who is, you know, he did a lot of the original work back in the very early 80s on inflation, and you probably saw that he wrote this little essay for the website edge.org, saying that he's basically given up on inflation and is looking for other explanations for the cosmic origin.
Yeah, I think it's an exaggeration to say he's given up. When I asked him personally whether he believes in inflation or the cyclic model of the universe that he's now working on, he said that he would give them equal odds, 50-50 odds in the absence of a better theory. But it's clear why he's working on alternatives, because alternatives are good. Everyone, you know, no one is protective about the idea of inflation. We want to know what is the right answer. It's very, very hard. For the last 30 years, any young hotshot theoretical cosmologist would have loved to come up with a better idea to understand these problems than inflation, and it hasn't happened yet. Paul gives the cyclic universe idea a 50-50 chance. I think most of us give it a much smaller chance than that. It doesn't really address the fundamental issues as well as inflation does.
The cyclic universe is, it seems like such a throwback. So I remember when I was first getting interested in cosmology in the 70s, their cyclic models were very popular. And I think one of the reasons for their popularity was that these models of the universe constantly regenerating itself, being created, dying, created again, appear in Hindu cosmology. So it sort of fed all that interaction between Eastern mysticism and physics that got lots of people excited in the 60s and 70s. But then in the 90s, nobody was talking about those again, and so suddenly they're back. Why? Why? What's the renewed interest in these models?
Well, I think a major thing happened to cosmology, first in the 1920s and then in the 1950s, when people began to take seriously the Big Bang. It's very hard to sort of put yourself in the shoes of a cosmologist 100 years ago who didn't know about general relativity, didn't know the universe was expanding. They would have thought the universe lasted forever. According to Newtonian mechanics, the universe doesn't get created or shrink or grow. It just remains the same size, time is absolute, and it goes on forever. And lately I've been reading papers by Boltzmann and some of the other giants of statistical mechanics in the 1890s arguing back and forth about why the entropy of the early universe was low. And it's tremendously fun to read these because every argument we're having now, they were having then. Boltzmann was proposing multiple universes, he was proposing cyclic universes, he was proposing that there was an initial condition and the universe did start, all of the different scenarios that we still entertain today.
Now, is that exciting or dispiriting that there's really nothing new under the sun in cosmology?
No, I think it's very exciting because the reason why that dialogue that they were having in the 1890s died out was because of the Big Bang, because people realized, aha, the universe doesn't last forever, there is a beginning, and so your job changes. Instead of trying to explain an eternal evolution of the universe, you need to explain the beginning of the universe, and that's difficult, and it is hard to make progress on that. And I think in the last 10 years, the source of progress has been the realization that once you take seriously quantum mechanics, not just classical general relativity, it's very plausible that the Big Bang was not the beginning of time, the beginning of everything, that there was something before the Big Bang. And so that adds another tool to your toolbox. You've learned something that Boltzmann didn't know, but then you can revisit the same kinds of questions. If the Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe, then the universe could very easily be eternal. And then you re-ask these questions. Okay, now with our understanding of general relativity and quantum mechanics Boltzmann didn't have, we can have those same debates again. Is it more likely the universe is cyclic and just sort of recycles over and over again in some sort of Nietzschean nightmare of recurrence? Or is the universe expanding forever and ever in one direction? Is there some uniform thing? Is there really a beginning? And so forth. And I think, so the difference now is that we are allowed to ask the same questions that Boltzmann was asking, but we have a much better handle on what the answers can look like. Steinhardt and Turok are pushing this cyclic universe idea, where the universe seems to expand and contract again. And I think that most of us don't like it for different reasons. My personal reason for not liking it is because it really avoids the question of the arrow of time in the second law of thermodynamics. It just assumes there is a universal arrow of time that stretches throughout all of eternity, which seems to me to be a wildly unwarranted assumption. But going back to before the Big Bang and trying to understand how inflation fits in are definitely going to be part of understanding these questions that are over 100-year-old questions.
Okay, now you've just set up your... I'd like you to describe the theory that I just read about in Discover Magazine that you and, I guess, a former student named... Chen?
I wrote a paper with Jennifer Chen, yes.
Yes, that you guys have worked out. But before that, let so I understand the cyclic universe correctly, I thought that you had to have the closed universe. So in other words, the only way that you could get endless cycles of creation and then collapse and creation again is if there's enough mass in the universe that eventually, and this is what is referred to as a closed universe, that eventually the expansion stops and it collapses again and into a big crunch, and then there's this kind of rebound and another big bang after that. That was the old model. Mm-hmm. Is this new model of Turok and Steinhardt different from that? Are they assuming that they somehow get a cyclic universe out of an open universe?
Yeah, it's very different. And I think, again, because we've learned a lot about how physics works. When in the 50s and 60s people were talking about bangs and crunches, they were basically guessing. You know, they had the laws of general relativity, classical general relativity, and that said that at early times or at late times in a recollapsing universe, you hit a singularity, and you didn't know what happened, and so you sort of shrugged your shoulders and said, well, maybe it bounces. We don't know why.
Yeah.
The difference now is that we have physical tools at our disposal, and we can try to make models of why the universe actually would bounce. And these models include, you know, extra dimensions, and they include new scalar fields, and new quantum mechanical things that change the structure of space-time on small scales. And so the old idea that in order for the universe to recollapse, you needed a closed, spatially positively curved universe just is no longer true. And in fact, it's more complicated than that, because in the Turok-Steinhardt model, whether or not the universe recollapses is not a universal statement. It's a statement that depends on your point of view, depends on your frame of reference, if you like. To the point of view of an ordinary person living in that universe forever, let's say, the universe would not recollapse. What would happen would be that the energy density of empty space would start increasing around them. Mm-hmm. So the energy density cycles. It goes from very, very large in the early universe, it decreases to a small value today, then it starts increasing, and that increase eventually leads to what people in the future will see as another Big Bang. But the universe does not actually start collapsing in that picture, so it's a completely different kind of cyclic cosmology.
Well, so now explain your model, which I guess involves the arrow of time and entropy and all those sorts of impossibly abstract topics.
Entropy is not very abstract. You see it in your kitchen every day. So entropy is one of the most down-to-earth things. I think that's why it's a good handle on trying to understand the large-scale structure of the universe, because it's one of those aspects of physics we really understand very well.
It's just that it's one of those concepts, though. It's sort of like information. It's that one of those things that when you think about it for a brief period of time, it makes perfect sense and it seems quite comprehensible, but the more you think about it, the more slippery it gets. At least this is true in my case. But anyway, go ahead and explain how your model works.
I think, so the important thing here is actually, as a disclaimer, not our model. I mean, we have a little model. I don't even really believe it myself. But the thing that I think is important is the larger program of trying to understand, again, dynamically, through mechanisms, through explanations, rather than just through fiat and saying that's like what it is, why the early universe has a low entropy and the entropy increases. Boltzmann told us in very concrete, microscopic terms why entropy will tend to increase naturally if you start in a condition where the entropy is low. But he didn't tell us, and what he was trying to explain in these different scenarios he was putting forward is why the entropy was ever low in the first place. So again, you have a choice to make. Are you just going to say, well, that's because, like, that's how it was, the universe had a low entropy, and don't bother me about it? Or is there some physics, is there some explanation for why our observable universe appears to have a low entropy? And I think that in something like inflation, it's just taken for granted, it's just sort of put in there as an initial condition, which I find unsatisfying. In something like the cyclic universe, the entropy increases forever and ever in the same direction. So if you go into the infinite past, there is an extraordinarily low entropy, more or less without any explanation. So I think that the kinds of cosmologies that I would prefer are ones where the entropy didn't start really, really low simply as an initial condition. So in order for that to happen, since the entropy was low at the Big Bang, there needs to be something before the Big Bang that did not have a low entropy. So we imagine that there was a universe pre-existing before the Big Bang that had a very, very high entropy, and that into the future and into the past, it gives rise to baby universes, to new parts of space-time in which the entropy locally starts low and then grows. So if you go very far into the future, you're creating more universes, and the entropy continues to increase and increase. And if you go into the far past, you're creating new universes, and the entropy continues to increase and increase.
Right.
And I think that the important, there's two important things here. One is that there's a symmetry. The far, far past looks the same as the far, far future. And number two, you're using laws of physics that Boltzmann had no concept of, that he had no grasp of, taking advantage of those concepts to try to dynamically generate the second law of thermodynamics in the arrow of time that we see. That's not something that he possibly could have invented. He would really be stuck because he had Newtonian mechanics.
And the physics that you're using are, I mean, is this, are you depending on some kind of inflationary physics to generate these low entropy states?
Well, we don't generate the low entropy states using inflation, but inflation plays a crucial role because one of the good things that inflation does can take a very tiny patch of space with no particles in it and blow it up to a huge patch of space with a huge number of particles. One of the things that needs to be explained about the universe in which we live right now is that there's 10 to the 88th particles in the observable universe. That is a lot of particles. And in the early universe, that same number of particles was squeezed into an unimaginably tiny region of space. And so why is that? That's something that inflation does a very good job of explaining. It is able to turn a small amount of space devoid of particles into a much larger space and populate it with a lot of particles. So that is a crucial ingredient in our imagination. That's why I'm happy that inflation seems to be making predictions that are consistent with what we learn about the microwave background.
Sean, so probably the biggest problem that I have with modern cosmology is the readiness of theorists to bring other universes into their models to explain features of this universe. So my guess is that we will never have even decent circumstantial evidence of these other universes, whether they're baby universes or whether they're connected to our universe by space, or whether they're somehow parallel to ours and exist in some hyperspace. I mean, there's so many different versions of multiverses now that are predicted by inflation or by the many worlds model of quantum mechanics or by string theory or loop space theory. And this just seems to me to be, it's not scientific in the way that, I don't know, building the standard model of particle physics was scientific, and or molecular biology is scientific. It really seems something that's distinct from the rest of science, and that's why I often mock it and compare it, and it's, I'm not alone in comparing it to theology, angels dancing on the heads of pins, and so forth. You're obviously a really smart, well-informed guy. Why should any of the rest of us take these sorts of theories seriously?
Well, the good news is you don't have to. I mean, there's plenty of science out there for everyone.
Okay.
The touchstone that I always refer to is a very nice explanation that was given in this book by David Deutsch called The Fabric of Reality.
Yes.
David Deutsch is one of the pioneers of quantum computing, and he's also a big defender of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is sort of related to what you're talking about. And he's trying to answer the question, who cares about the many worlds interpretation of quantum? It's not going to make you build a better transistor or something like that. And he chooses as his foil a quote by Steven Weinberg in his book on gravitation and cosmology. And, you know, you can't argue with Steven Weinberg in terms of being an incredibly successful physicist and who knows what he's talking about.
And hard-nosed.
And hard-nosed, that's right.
Yeah.
And a big supporter of string theory also. But in the Gravitation and Cosmology book, Weinberg sort of temporarily diverts himself into the philosophy of science, and he says, all this talk about curved space-time and metrics and geodesics and so forth is beside the point. It may or may not be useful, but the point is to predict the locations of stars as they appear on a photographic plate. That's the ultimate point of science, he says, taking a hard-nosed instrumentalist viewpoint. And Deutsch says, you know, that could not possibly be more wrong. The point of science is to understand how nature works. And the example he gives is, what if I had a black box that I could hand to Steven Weinberg? And this black box had the feature that if you wrote a question about the behavior of the physical universe on a piece of paper, and you stuck it into the black box, and you asked, if I collide these particles together, what is the cross-section or something like that? The black box would spit out the correct answer every single time. And Deutsch says, would that count as the final answer to all the laws of physics? Would that be all you wanted? And the answer is, of course not, because it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't give you any understanding of what is happening. It's just telling you the answers. The ultimate thing that science is after is not just an instrumentalist prediction for where the photons land on a photographic plate. It's an appreciation for what is the underlying mechanism that is going on. And when scientists, when cosmologists or string theorists or whatever, appeal to things you can't see, other branches of the wave function of the universe, other dimensions, other parts of the multiverse outside, it's because they believe it is helping us understand something about the part of the universe that we do see. It would certainly be more economical and more preferable in everyone's mind if I could explain what I observed near the Big Bang using only physics that occurs within the observable universe. But I don't think I can, and therefore I'm trying to make what we see in our local universe understandable and appear natural in a broader framework. There's certainly, you know, the fact of the matter is that the speed of light is finite. It's one light year per year. That means there will be parts of the universe that I can't observe because they're too far away. Our universe is embedded in that larger universe. If I can appeal to features of that larger universe to explain naturally our local universe, I will consider that a success.
Do you ever, I guess I'm asking, it seems to me that we're really in the realm of sociology here. I guess it's my prediction, and I'm trying to figure out where physics is going. First of all, I see what's going on now in physics as the result of all these really brilliant, curious, ambitious people beating their heads against the limits of current theory, being totally dissatisfied with the status quo. There are all these great mysteries that are still unanswered by the really sort of accepted theories we have. And so they are forced to become more and more speculative and go further and further in what they accept as a possible answer to some of their questions. And I just think this is a sort of the all the sound and fury that you get with the decline of a great field, and that in the future, I'm sorry to reprise my tired old argument, but I really find it fascinating, and I guess and the multiverse stuff I find is the most obvious example of what I'm talking about. I'm just making a sociological prediction that not only most scientists, but most people in the and not only the those stodgy Nobel Prize committee people, but the public, except for maybe the New Agers who love string theory and multiverse theories, they've embraced it. I think there will never be the kind of acceptance of these explanations that you've gotten for quantum mechanics and relativity, or for evolution, and the theories that are really part of our foundation of knowledge. I would be very surprised if that happens.
Well, you're welcome to have predictions. Predictions are cheap. I mean, there's a very large number of very smart people who are predicting the other side, and we'll have to see ultimately. I think that there is something interesting to say, which is that at many parts of the current state of progress in theoretical physics, we're driven to the edges of what is easily observable. And what we're trying to do is to construct a more comprehensive framework that both accounts for what is easily observable and can provide natural explanations for the edges of what is easily observable. So if it weren't for the fact that we have both gravity and quantum mechanics, people wouldn't be thinking about string theory. These are things you observe in the universe. There is gravity and there is quantum mechanics. And so you would like to invent a theory that reconciles those two things. And in your attempts to invent such a theory, you're driven to say there are extra dimensions of space-time. In cosmology, we observe the early universe. It has certain features, and we're trying to explain that. And in that attempt to explain it, we drive ourselves to imagine inflation, or things that happen at a much higher energy scale. In terms of the arrow of time and laws of thermodynamics, you observe that when you break an egg, you can't unbreak it. And in attempts to explain that, we are driven to talk about what happens before the Big Bang. So these are all very speculative ideas, and even if we can't test any specific idea in isolation, we're trying to fit it into a larger framework which hopefully will be testable. And the reason that we're driven to invent these speculative ideas is because of things that we observe. It's a very long-term project. It's not something where, because I have a certain idea of how our universe occurred as a baby universe by a quantum fluctuation in a pre-existing multiverse, therefore I can predict a certain temperature profile of the cosmic microwave background. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
But hopefully, taken together, a whole set of observations will help us narrow down the possibilities and we'll come to some sort of understanding that fits everything we do observe. And it might very well involve elements that we can't observe.
You know, I just read yesterday this wonderful little mini essay that you had on, I think the title is How Hard It Is to Be a Heretic.
Yes, being a heretic is hard work. Yes.
Being a heretic is hard work. And
I was shocked that, according to Google, no one had ever said that phrase before, being a heretic is hard work. So I guess no one recognized it, yes.
Well, it's something that I thought a lot about. In a way, well, you know, science writers love heretics. So we're always looking for, you know, the heretic, the maverick, the person who's bucking up against the status quo. The last thing you want to do as a journalist is say, the Big Bang Theory is holding up fine. Yeah, the Standard Model just explained all the new data coming out of the LHC. But of course, young scientists don't become scientists so that they can uphold the status quo either. You want to, you know, everybody wants to be the next revolutionary. You want to be the next Einstein or Darwin or so forth. And then once you become a scientist, you realize how hard won our knowledge is, and you end up defending yourself against bad science or just not necessarily bad science, but just science that isn't as good as what already has been accepted through very hard work and after multiple testing. And so it was fascinating to see you describe this kind of change in your own self-conception. And yet, I see theoretical physics as being, you know, a lot of my job is trying to distinguish, as a friend of mine puts it, cranks from visionaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you tell the real thing, the next Einstein, from you know, the vaster number of scientists who are just going to be cranks and their theories are going to be tossed in the dustbin of history? And yet now you have a situation where people like yourself, you know, this respected figure at one of the top scientific institutions in the world, and people at Stanford and Harvard and all the leading institutions around the world are upholding theories that I find, you know, I think, and again, I'm not alone, you know, that seem to me to be in the realm of cranky science.
So, well, again, the good news is that there's plenty of other science out there that is grounded in the real world, if that's what you find more interesting. If the kinds of speculative stuff that involves the multiverse or extra dimensions continues to grind on without making progress, people will naturally lose interest. So far, the reason why people are interested is because we are, in fact, learning more and more, and occasionally we figure out ways to compare it to data. In fact, you know, Boltzmann, 150 years ago, when he was trying to explain the second law of thermodynamics using atoms, which were not known to exist at the time and were not highly accepted by physicists, was ridiculed by some people because, you know, these atoms are these little tiny things that you could never observe. He's using them to explain things like the second law of thermodynamics, which we've already perfectly well established. What is the point of this?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, these are long-term projects trying to understand very hard questions. And the nature of science is that the questions that it addresses will change with time. The techniques it uses will change with time. Of course, these are smart individual people who are trying to make progress. If an increasing number of actual young people coming into science don't think that this kind of research is promising, it will just naturally die out. There's no,
right.
You know, there's no sense of crisis or anything like that. The reason why it's becoming increasingly popular is because a lot of people do think it's promising.
What about, I have to get your comments on the anthropic principle, which is another thing that drives me crazy and I find is evidence that a lot of you guys are going off the deep end. So I actually don't know what your position on the anthropic principle is.
Well, so there's the anthropic principle is this idea that we can somehow explain features of the universe around us by imagining that our local features are part of a wider ensemble, and we can only observe those pieces of the ensemble where the conditions are appropriate for life to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of a, you know, a simple-minded version of this which is completely obviously true, namely, you know, here in the solar system, it is not a surprise that life grew up on the surface and atmosphere of the Earth rather than in between the planets. And the reason why is because conditions are much more hospitable for life here on the surface of Earth than they are in the desolate cold of interplanetary space. So something like this is clearly true. The controversial aspect of it is to try to apply the same idea to our entire observable universe, to say that we can explain features of our entire observable universe by saying that there is a much bigger ensemble of many parts of a multiverse where conditions are very, very different, and most of them we don't observe because life couldn't exist there. And I think there's sort of two extreme positions to take. One is that that's true, the multiverse really is there, it is like that, and I have a theory that does use it correctly to explain a certain feature. Another extreme position is, it's not true, and not only is it not true, it's nonsense, there's no content to it, it's all just theology.
Mm-hmm.
And my position is in between. I think that it is certainly very plausible that there are different parts of the universe that we don't see. We can't be parochial about it. We know there's parts of the universe we can't see. It's certainly very possible that the conditions there are very different. I have no way of knowing whether they're the same or different. On the other hand, I think that it attempts to actually use that idea to quantitatively calculate an expected value for something that we observe here in our universe is very premature right now. Maybe someday we'll be able to do it, but the state of the art is just not nearly developed enough to make anything like that happen with any confidence. So I'm certainly willing to say that moving in that direction will ultimately help us understand something, but I'm not willing to say that, you know, we now understand the hierarchy between the electroweak mass scale and the Planck scale or the value of the dark energy or something like that using anthropic reasoning.
I thought that there was another version of the anthropic principle, the strong anthropic principle, I think it's sometimes called, that says that the universe must have a form that allows for the existence of life because consciousness is somehow necessary for reality. So I think some of the original versions of the anthropic principle invoked the role of the observer in quantum mechanics to make this case. Does anybody take that seriously anymore?
No.
Okay. Because then it seems
that just sounds completely crazy to me. Anyway, yeah, I mean, and that's not at all what is being talked about by people who look at the string theory landscape of vacua or anything like that.
Right, but so it seems to me that the reason it's been dragged back into respectable discourse is because of the rising popularity of multiverse theory. So if you've got zillions of universes out there, why do we happen to find ourselves in this one? And for some people, I guess, the anthropic principle reduces the sense of arbitrariness that we have in looking out at this universe and pondering our own existence.
Well, I mean, I can't speak for everyone. It might do that, but I think there's a much more down-to-earth motivation for most people thinking about it, which is, again, we're trying to take features that we do observe in our local universe and use them as clues to a deeper understanding. So if you observe something in our universe that seems unlikely, if there's two different numbers that by all rights in a randomly chosen theory, whatever that means, should be the same number, but in fact they're different by a factor of 10 to the 30th or something like that, maybe there's an explanation for that in that we are not a randomly chosen theory, that we are part of a bigger ensemble, and we are going to be chosen from the subset of that ensemble where life is allowed to exist. It's really trying to explain observed numbers by imagining there's a much larger universe in which we're embedded. It's not the major motivation that is driving people has nothing to do with consciousness or the meaning of life.
That's too bad, because it would be much more fun for me if you guys embraced something that flaky. Sean, I just have to hold. I'm holding something up here.
Okay.
I'm sure you must have seen it. It's the cover of the March Scientific American, and I didn't want to hold it up at the beginning of this conversation, because then I felt it would lead some viewers to think that there was no point to watching further. It says, of course, "The End of Cosmology," and it's the article written by Larry Krauss and Robert Scherer.
Yeah.
So, the gist of this is that these guys have done projections of...
Yeah, this is not a very scary end of cosmology. This is not the end
right.
of cosmologists. This is just saying that in trillions of years, the universe will cool off and everything will separate out and that we won't be around to see what happens in the
right.
in the very far future, which trillions of years in the future is not my most immediate concern.
That's right. It's not the end of cosmology that that I predicted.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting points that they made came at the very end of the article. I don't know if you saw that. They say that, you know, projecting in the future, if there's been some kind of discontinuity, which there probably would be, in knowledge, and you had a whole new species possibly inventing a whole new science, they wouldn't have a clue about the origin of the universe. They might not even see other galaxies out there. They would just be looking out into black and empty space. And so, okay, that's kind of, you know, fun and weird and disturbing to think about. But then these guys say, well, maybe this has already happened to an extent, and there are really important things that happened in the early universe that we're not aware of because it's already expanded so much. So I just wonder if that's something that you would take seriously.
Well, in the most general reading, yes, I would take that very seriously. We're... one of the times, sometimes when I'm talking about the anthropic principle, an analogy I like to use is, what if we were sort of primitive astronomers on a world where the upper atmosphere was completely opaque, and you couldn't see anything past the atmosphere, you didn't know there was a sky. So as far as you were concerned, the local features on your planet, the temperature and the atmospheric pressure and so forth, were fundamental features of nature. You didn't know there was such a thing as other planets, and you were trying to invent a theory of everything that explained the temperature on your atmosphere. And someone comes along and says, well, my theory is that there are other planets also, and that the temperature is not a universal constant. It's different on different planets, and we were born on this planet because of local features of life. And, you know, your favorite science journalist ridiculed you as doing theology and so forth. But that real world that we live in is exactly analogous to that. We have an atmosphere past which we can't see, and it's called the cosmic microwave background. If you look back using light, which travels at the speed of light, you bump into an opaque barrier at recombination, at the point where atoms went from being free electrons and free protons to being combined hydrogen atoms. Earlier than that, the universe is opaque. You can't see before that. We're trying to be clever. We're trying to use other things other than photons to see a little bit further than that, using neutrinos or gravitational waves or whatever. But there is a limit past which we can't possibly see. So if you say, well, is it conceivable that something happens beyond that limit, either in space or in time? I think that the only sensible answer is, sure, it's absolutely conceivable. And if you can take advantage of that conception to somehow explain and make more natural the part of the universe we do see, then I think that counts as moving forward.
You know, it reminds me of that Arthur C. Clarke, I think it's Arthur C. Clarke, short story where you've got a planet that I think they've got three or four suns, And every few thousand years...
It was Isaac Asimov, actually, yes.
Oh, okay.
Nightfall, a classic story.
Yeah, and so I guess the sun's all very rarely set, and then suddenly stars appear, and the people look up in the sky and see thousands of stars, and as I recall, they all go insane.
Yeah, there were riots and, you know, looting and so forth.
So maybe
a great
TV
show, actually, yes.
So maybe you guys, if you do discover the secret of the universe, you should be careful in how you reveal it to humanity with our simple minds.
Well, no, one of my things is that ordinary people who are not well-versed in science love this stuff. And by this stuff, I mean everything from trying to explain the entropy when an egg breaks and you try to make an omelet and you can't turn the omelet back into an egg, to modern cosmology with its measurement of the dark energy density and the mass of neutrinos and so forth, to speculations about the multiverse and what happens beyond what we can see. We go from these very tangible stuff literally around us every day to speculations about things beyond the universe around us. And when I talk to people about this, people who know nothing about the background, they eat it up. And I think that we should not underestimate the curiosity and the willingness of people who are not experts and surrounded by the discourse in this field to appreciate and be interested in this.
You know, believe it or not, Sean, I still love it too, and I love the leaps of imagination you guys take. I feel it's sort of my job to point out when those leaps are taking you particularly far from really solid evidence, but I still follow this whole field very avidly. I find it fascinating, and you know, I hope it all works out. I hope you guys have all sorts of revolutionary discoveries in the future.
We'll have to see. Yes, stay tuned for Blogging Heads next year, where I'll tell you all the secrets to what happened before the Big Bang.
I look forward to it.
All right, John, thanks very much.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.